LJ Weber, that's W-E-B-E-R. The website of interest is earliestchicagomaps.com. And we're talking about the exploration of the area. And somebody in the chat room asked if you had planned to mention Fort Dearborn and how that occurred. So take her away.
Right, yeah. Well, no, because my period is specifically 1650 to 1700. And there's a whole lot, I mean, most of Chicago history, of course, is after that. And all of the things about Fort Dearborn and later DuSable and all that stuff, I don't get into. And I don't think I would have anything different to say that than has already been said. But the stuff about the origin of Chicago, the word, and these maps, a reorganization and attribution of these maps, and see which some are phony and some are, have to be changed around and reattributed, that's original work. So the question is, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to get into that.
Okay.
But I noticed your music, the last break coming in here just now, was your old song, but I noticed there was different music earlier. Is that right?
Yes. There's breakout music, and then there's regular music. I use a couple of different songs.
Well, here's something I might suggest. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Could you hear that?
Well, could you hear that? I can't really use anything copyrighted.
I know you can't. I know. It's kind of a joke.
Yeah.
You know the song, right? Of course, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know the song, right?
Yes.
I was really into
music a lot when I was growing up. Instead of listening to a lot of the popular music, I was listening to Ferranti and Teicher and classical music. I didn't have a typical teenage years.
I see. Well, half the side of my whole personality and history is with music.
Mm.
And it is. And I have a whole, you know, I did a whole lots of things and still do all the time. And but that's another story. Let's see, is it another? Yeah, it is another story. So anyway, here we are now, and I was just doing this. I'll bring it back up. Let's see here. The earliest uses of Chicago word. Oh, I was going to say these dates. The earliest uses of the Chicago word were in a letter of 1679, LaSalle, and in 1683 was the last of these four instances I gave on a map, a location, and physical space, a river, and a portage. And in 1683, that's the map. This is the map that I discovered is, in fact, LaSalle's map. It's been attributed to somebody else. Actually, they categorized. Anyway, these maps back in, I think, 1926 at the Newbery. And they have a lot of this stuff. It could be updated in various ways. And so they gave this map is attributed to one person named Manet, and it's called 1685, and it should be LaSalle 1683. And the map is kind of a chronological map because there are earlier things on the map and later things on the map. And the latest thing on the map that I could identify was 1683, so I used that as the date for the map. And the invariable spelling was C-H-E-C-A-G-O-U, C-H-E-C-A-G-O, with the U on the end. And in French, you would pronounce this Chicago.
Ah.
So that's you know, when someone tries to pronounce that, that's simply the French pronunciation of this spelling. And what you got here, it's a rendering into French of the Spanish Chicago. C-H-U. And there's things about the letter E in French and the letter U in French where they're reduced to schwa, which is an unaccented syllable. Sound does not exist in English. It's a front rounded vowel like e. And so when they saw the Spanish U, C-H-U, they translated it as a C-H-E. And I have a good explanation, and I have my own explanation, but I have a fortified by a European expert on these things. And I have a full discussion of this in my article on Chicago on my website. How do you get from French C-H-E to Spanish C-H-U? And then on the end, the O-U, Chicago, of LaSalle's Chicago, was put into French from the agua. And that actually, just a quick answer, it gets kind of complicated, and you really can't understand it unless you know what the hell I'm talking about. It took me a long time to figure this stuff out. But anyway, LaSalle's Chicago was literally, with only literally a few exceptions, was used until the coming of the English in the 1750s. And so I have many, many maps where you have LaSalle's word, and this smelly onion word, it's not on any of those maps, just a very few. And the development of this, the evolution of the smelly onion word is interesting in itself. And really the form it takes where we have now is with the coming of the English, who could not handle the C-H-E because that sound doesn't exist in English. And so they used the C-H-I, which was in existence already with Joutel, the folk etymology word. And so the C-H-I came to be used that way. Today, the spelling with C-H-I was not a mere variation of LaSalle C-H-E, as quackademics have always seemed to believe. LaSalle was of a completely different, his word was of a completely different origin than the folk etymology, which for anyone today who has ideas about it, they say it was named after that wild onion type plant, the Allium trichocum, brought to the modern eye, as I said, by John Kirkland in 1892, not by a later writer. Discussed below, this was based on this wild onion idea, one anecdotal comment recorded by a Frenchman, this is the Joutel I was talking about, from an Indian in 1687. He was passing through the area, and in his journal, which spanned 4 years, Joutel, he wrote C-H-I-C-A-G-O-U, the Chicago word with a U at the end of it. Mm-hmm. And let's see, I think I'll say it now. The one anecdotal comment was recorded, and he wrote, "By what we have learned, the area was named after the plant that grew in abundance in the area." And he wrote the Chicago word with a U on the end of it. And what it is the Indians told him the word for skunk. And whether they were joking with him or whatever the case was, you know, pulling a fast one on the white guy, they told him this place is named after the skunk because the plant does smell. And so you see the connection there, whether or not the Indians are putting them on, because the Indians would have known that the name of the plant was Juanacecia. The name of the Allium trichocum was Juanacecia. And the Chicago word was the name for the skunk that was used for the plant, just as skunk is used for the plant marijuana. And as I said, LaSalle's Chicago word was based on a 1670 Paris published translation from a Spanish narrative about the De Soto expedition. The De Soto expedition was from 1539 to 1543. De Soto died en route. The Spanish entered and explored North America, entering from the Gulf of Mexico, and traversed roughly the southeast quadrant of the current United States. So the southeast quadrant, and this is the area where the French were interested in going when they pushed through the Great Lakes and they were pushing to the Mississippi. They wanted to know where the Mississippi went. And so the 1670 Paris published book with this description of the beautiful river, the biggest river, a river, the Rio Grande, a river like you would never see anywhere else. And wow. And that's written and it discharges into the Bay of the Holy Spirit, Bahía del Espíritu Santo, at the Gulf of Mexico. And so that's where La Salle thought he would come out. We took a break right where La Salle was going to come out, and he came out at the wrong place. It wasn't the description in that 1670 book. It was he came out at a different place, a marsh delta, which was a swamp of sorts, and not this beautiful bay, which was, as I said, the Bahía del Espíritu Santo, the Bay of the Holy Spirit. And now the book came out in 1670, and the Sanson maps, Sanson with Sanson, sounds like that. The Sanson maps was a famous family of map makers who started in 1650 and made a definitive map of North America for its time, by all means. And the Great Lakes were roughly put in there, and there's some story how that happened. But anyway, the Sanson map, 1650, that's where I start my map collection, 1650, that map was used by European map makers all over as a template because it was such a great map. The French school of map making, Sanson, was of value there. So what happened in 1674, 4 years after the book was published with the description of the Chicagua, the Spanish Chicagua, Agua on the end, and the Bay of the Holy Spirit where it would empty, a map came out from the Sanson Company. It wasn't Sanson because he died in 1667, but the company continued. And actually, it's called Sanson Jaillot because somebody acquired the plates for making the maps. And so 1674, the map came out with the Chicagua River. And that's where LaSalle thought he would come out in this beautiful bay, and it was called the Chicagua River. But when he sailed with a group of 55 people. Almost all of them were Indians, and they wanted to bring their wives, and the wives wanted to bring their children, so a whole big troop went down there. And there's some famous paintings of La Salle taking possession at the Gulf of the Mississippi River of Louisiana. And, I'll just interject here if I remember where to get back to, but Louisiana, the original Louisiana was comprised of 34 of today's United States. It was a huge part of land in the middle of the continent. And when you say Louisiana and this, they say, oh, Louisiana Purchase? No, a lot more than that. The original Louisiana was defined as everything that emptied into the Gulf of Mexico. Everything. So all the way from the New York and Alleghenies, all the way to the Rocky Mountains, all Louisiana, 34 states. And anyway, Chicago was of significant geographical importance because of this reason, is because in Chicago, the Chicago River emptied into Lake Michigan. And Lake Michigan, of course, the water went through the Great Lakes and out eventually to the St. Lawrence River and then out into the Gulf of St. Lawrence from the Chicago River. However, just a little bit inland from the Chicago River was the Des Plaines River. And the Des Plaines River went to the Illinois River. And you would know this because you know the geography out here somewhat, or maybe a lot. And so the Des Plaines River emptied into the Illinois River, which emptied into the Mississippi River, which emptied into the Gulf of Mexico. So literally, in Chicago, part of Chicago emptied into the St. Lawrence, the Gulf of St. Lawrence, at the end of the St. Lawrence River. And the other part of Chicago emptied into the Gulf of Mexico. So you could literally stand in some place in Chicago on a little hill or something, and with 1 foot in Louisiana and 1 foot in Canada. Because what defined Louisiana was everything that emptied into the Gulf of Mexico. So, I mean, this is really, really an interesting thing, that you could stand at 1 foot in Canada, or New France, as you would call Nouvelle France, or 1 foot in Louisiana. So Chicago, most of Chicago was part of the original Louisiana. And when people say, oh, the Louisiana Purchase, that's much different and much later. And it's part of a whole different story. The original Louisiana, as I said, was everything that emptied into the Gulf of Mexico. And so LaSalle Chicago was based on that translation. And let's see, more of 1682 Mississippi discharged. river. So I call what I call the River of DeSoto is what was called the Chicagua. So I had called that. That's my designation. LaSalle believed that the Mississippi would lead to the River of DeSoto. That's my designation. And so I had this thing about getting a pencil, but I said that before. And back to history, back to some history. I hope there's some questions. Well, if there's, maybe they're piling up. I don't know. But it's not too often that I get to talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. And you can see that I'm just getting started, maybe.
That's okay.
Thank you.
This is the talk show, after all.
I know. And also, if somebody doesn't like it, we know what they can do. It's they can flip-click.
Right.
Yeah. So here's, now getting back to the story, the Europeans, since the time of Columbus, they were looking for a shortcut to China. Maybe this has come through a little bit when people discover, when they look at Columbus. For various reasons, they were looking for a shortcut to China, because the fall of the Eastern Christian Church, now pretty much said to be the Byzantine Empire, but it was a Christian church, in 1453, it fell to the Islamic Jihad. For hundreds of years, they were trying to get to it, and they never got to it, but in 1453, it fell. And so it's been renamed Istanbul. And it blocked the Silk Road, which is the road between Europe and Asia. And it had to give some a little bit of qualification, because it didn't block it at all times and every place and all this, because there's a lot of history, lots of flexibility. And a lot of people could use a Silk Road, but they might have to pay a tax on it or a levy and that kind of thing. And so anyway, it was an alternate. The Europeans wanted to find an alternate route to China. And so this idea about being blocked, the Silk Road being blocked by Islamic Jihad, is not too frequently alluded to. And it's not the only reason, but it's a reason there. And so they were looking for the China of Marco Polo. Marco Polo, in the late 1200s, spent 20 years in Asia, mostly China. And he came back to Europe, Italy, and he told all these tales about the great China. And so that was a continuing impetus for, how are we going to get there? Although, apparently, a lot of them did get over the Silk Road. And so Columbus, the name here, Columbus, we know the date for that. And he thought he would get to Cathay. We heard of that. That's the name for China. And what Columbus had with him was the Toscanelli map of 1474. The Toscanelli map of 1474. That's almost two decades before Columbus. And he had that map. And unfortunately, for Columbus, when he bumped into, he thought he was in Asia immediately. And so that's why the Indians are called Indians, because he thought he was going to bump into India. But what happened is we have a quote scientific conclusion back in the ancient Greeks of Eratosthenes, who calculated, they say he calculated the circumference of the earth. But he really kind of messed up, because where Japan is now, where they had it on the Toscanelli map was about where Mexico would be. So I have Toscanelli's map on my website. You can check that out. No, I have it in my map collection. And you can see very clearly, when you overlay a modern geography on Toscanelli's map, that Japan on Toscanelli is about where Mexico is. So Eratosthenes kind of screwed up. Anyway, going back here, there's various maps of some importance, of lesser importance. But in the 1530s, in pursuing this etymology of Chicago and the history that led up to there in the French, in the 1530s, Jacques Cartier went up the St. Lawrence River 1,000 miles to about today's Montreal. And he came to a falls there and couldn't get past the whitewater and salt. Salt is another name for falls. And he established a French presence on the North American continent. And then it gets really exciting. So I'll tell you when we get back.
All righty. We will be right back after a break.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now, but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Ladies and gentlemen, J.R. Moore here. We have a special promotion going on at Republic Broadcasting. This is a fundraiser for Republic Broadcasting involving the Energy Planner. Mail me a postcard. My address is at my website at thelibertyman.com. We pick a postcard every other Thursday. When your postcard is drawn out, you get to buy an Energy Planner for $215 instead of $285, $70 discount. $200 goes to Republic Broadcasting. You also get a 10% discount on my mattress pads. So get those postcards in, put your name, your telephone number, your email address on there, and when your postcard is drawn, you get to get an Energy Planner for $215 instead of $285. Mattress pads, 10% off. Help us out at Republic Broadcasting and help yourself to get an Energy Planner at a deep discount. It's a win-win situation for everybody. We hope you can get these postcards in soon. Thank you very much.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
All right, welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest today is Carl J. Weber. His website is earliestchicagomaps.com. And Carl, that music that was playing right before we came back is a song that was written for my program by a listener. Oh. And I just love that song. It just epitomizes my feelings about life and brotherhood.
I'm happy to hear that. Nice, as we say now, nice. Yeah. I was talking about Jacques Cartier.
Right.
And in the 1530s, actually, he made four trips to the North America, and on one of those trips, he went up the St. Lawrence River 1,000 miles. He wrote a big report about this, too. It's available. He went up 1,000 miles to today's Montreal. And there's the Salt of St. Louis, as it's called there now, salt meaning waterfall. Just like when we say somersault, that salt there is the same thing. It means a forward falling. So the Salt of St. Louis. He established a French presence in the North American continent. And you can see on a succession of maps. But notably, the 1560s Mercator maps. Mercator, as a map maker, is probably the best-known map maker of these times. And so the maps of Mercator you'll see the presence of Jacques Cartier. You'll see the St. Lawrence River coming in 1,000 miles, and you'll see Montreal, and there it stops. And then it kind of continues on diagonally across the continent, most of the continent, aimed directly out to Southern California. So you can see how this image was planted in people's minds that, oh, well, somehow we're going to get to the Vermilion Sea, and it's just a hop, skip, and a jump over to get to China. With the Sanson maps, I said Sanson maps beginning in 1650, that's where I start my theme of exploration and discovery. So I'm much more meticulous coming up this way in the heartland of America. And it shows, the 1650 shows a sketch of the Great Lakes, but it's really sketchy and you can't figure out what's going on. It was the result of the exploration of Jean Nicolet in the 1630s under Champlain, the father of Canada. He founded Quebec in 1608, and he made a number of maps himself into the 1630s. Tentative explorations to the west took place, and they are seen on a succession of maps. But anyway, going up to 1650 with the Sanson and the tentative lakes of the tentative Great Lakes sketched in, but really you didn't see anything in the Mississippi or the lower lakes. And on these Sanson maps, the maps of up from the Gulf Coast relate nothing to anything. Now you'd think that maybe they should be a reflection of the DeSoto expedition, because DeSoto was all down there in this land, I said the southeast quadrant of North America. And what about his maps? Well, the thing about the Spanish is they explored overland. And so the rivers that they get to and all this and all that, they did not put them down in the same way that the French did, because the French explored by rivers and waterways. And so they could connect the rivers and they could be somewhat sure about the rivers. And so that's why the French maps are more accurate in the sense of this river, you get in here and you get out over there. And we don't get any geographical certitude until the middle 1700s with the discovery of how to calculate longitude. Longitude is the east to west, but they had latitude north to south, because that's simply, if the North Star is straight out, when you point straight level with the ground, you're at the equator. And if it's exactly up ahead, you're at the North Pole. So latitude is some one of those degrees in there. And so Chicago is at about 42 degrees. Now, as I said, the French had been, by the late 1600s, they'd been to the middle stretch of the Mississippi, of the area west of Illinois, but they didn't know where the river's going to come out. And they were influenced by the Mercator map. And the Mercator map is, it shows that this river could have gone straight across the whole continent. That was the diagonal across the continent, come out of the Pacific Ocean in the Southern California as the Vermilion Sea. Now, as a side note here, we're talking about this exploration, and the names of Joliet and Marquette are very familiar, as well as LaSalle. But if you look up what's going on with Marquette and Joliet, as you see, well, it was in 1673 when the humble and pious Marquette and the adventurous explorer Joliet, they struck out to the Mississippi and explored and discovered it and sailed it down to the Arkansas River and then came back because they were afraid that they'd be attacked by the Spanish who were down in the lower regions. And they came back. And there's a little bit more of what happened to Joliet and what happened to Marquette, but that's all a fabrication. And Marquette was never involved with any of this exploration. And this raises the whatever it is of lots of people, but it wasn't. And especially I say here that people like kids and professors at Marquette University, I don't mean to, you know, to burst their bubble or anything, but it should be, you know, how you write history. Years and years ago, I wrote to I talked on the phone with the head, the editor of the Jesuit magazine, and he said, oh, you got some different ideas about this? Well, go for it. Oh, go for it. So he was encouraging me that if I had some other ideas to put them down. So this is just something that I don't mean to ruffle the feathers or make anybody feel bad about the Jesuits, but that's the way that it was. They wanted to see where the Mississippi discharged. And so Joliet was given a commission by the French government in 1672. to explore to the west of the Great Lakes. Remember, the Mississippi, the middle regions opposite Illinois, say, were known by the 1660s. And it was not a commission to where the Mississippi discharged, as our history book says, but it was a commission to find a route to the, explicitly stated in the still surviving French documents, a commission to find a route to the Vermilion Sea, to go across the continent, not to go to the Gulf of Mexico, to go to the Pacific Ocean.
Wow.
I argue to the undelight of many, I made up that word, to many, that as observed by Francis Borges Stack in his market, go ahead, what?
That's a good word.
Oh, the undelight, yeah. Well, it was observed by Francis Borges Stack in his Marquette Legends of 1960 that Marquette was shoehorned into the 1673 first Mississippi exploration story. Shoehorned, well, I'll interject here first, that I stand on the shoulders of Francis Borges Stack. He got some very basic stuff done about this, the Marquette Joliet expedition, which he wrote about as his PhD dissertation in 1929. And it's a whole big thing published that it's published limitedly, but it's published about this. It's 1929. He's associated with Quincy University. I've been down there. I've been through all his papers. He died in 1962. In 1960, he wrote a book called Marquette Legends. And he had pushed his conclusions more and more and in 1960, he came up. He has one line in there. He said, it's doubtful whether Marquette participated at all in the expedition. And so, you know, he said it first. But he sent applications to have his book published. He wrote, I read his letters, to 50 different publishers, and no one was even interested in his stuff. Most of them didn't even answer him back. And it's because of his criticism of the Jesuits. And so even if Catholics are not Jesuits, they still have some kind of affinity and they don't want to rock the boat and there's all this stuff going on. And so he didn't get it. No one would publish his book. And so that was in 1960. And he came up with, I can specify the things he came up with and how I differ. But anyway, what happened was, I said that in 1682, LaSalle had navigated the Mississippi to its Gulf, and in April of that year, he came out in this desolate Gulf. Well, that was 1682. But what happened is the Jesuits, they wanted to claim some kind of precedence and priority in the Mississippi discovery. And so what they did is they shoehorned into the 1673 first Mississippi exploration story. That's the story of 1673. Now we know as Marquette and Joliet, but they put Joliet's name in there. And there was a book published in 1681, 2 years before LaSalle came out into the Gulf of Mexico. And the Jesuits wanted to have eminence of discovery. And so 1681, they wrote a whole narrative that was supposed to be in Marquette, first person. It starts off, I, Jacques Marquette. But no, it was fake. It wasn't Jacques Marquette. Incidentally, Jacques Marquette, he died in 1685, 6 years before the publication. But it could have been an older manuscript of Marquette's that was just being published, but it wasn't. It was a lie. 1681, first person narrative, it was published in a book of travel accounts. It was by a guy named Thévenot, Melchizedek Thévenot. And he published accounts of travelers here and there. And he published this in 1681, the story of Marquette. They put Joliet in. He put Joliet in there a little, but it was supposed to be, it came off to be like it was by Marquette. Now, and it opens with, the account opens with, as I said, I, Jacques Marquette, and so on. So here is the Jesuits' account of Marquette. Marquette was a Jesuit. And a little bit later, I can talk more about the Jesuits. And as I hear later, I'm going to give them a little spanking. So to see, they were a very powerful political force. This period in our history was feudal. It was a feudal time. Say, what is feudal? Feudalism, right? And it's a different way that society is set up and constructed. But anyway, the religious aspect of the culture and the society had an equal footing with political aspects too. So there were the religious. They were the first estate, and then there was the royalty, and then there were the commoners, and they were different. And the religious aspect, the religious people, they had very much to do and much to say in what was going on in the politics. And so they were very much part of the geopolitical construct of the times. And they're really not mentioned in this respect. But remember that when we're talking about the separation of church and state, this is the kind of thing that we're talking about, is that for the ecclesiastics not to have such a big say or any say in the goings-on of the government. They were a political force. And so this was published in 1681. To beat LaSalle to the punch. It was published in 1681, and it was very well known that LaSalle was on this expedition to check out and travel to Mexico by way of the Mississippi River. And there are records on there when on LaSalle's second return visit to France to meet in the court with the king, maybe with the king, with his ministers for sure. Although things are addressed from the king to LaSalle, but nonetheless, it might have been from his minister. The main minister was Colbert, looks like Colbert. And LaSalle was given the commission to explore the West, and the West means west of the Great Lakes. In 1678, that's when he went on his second return visit to France, and he got the commission, you can read it, it's available, to explore to the West. And everybody knew that, I mean, it was common knowledge that LaSalle was going to undergo this exploration. And so the Jesuits beat LaSalle to the punch, because LaSalle was just about getting ready, packing up his gear. He told the king, give me 20 years. It's in 1678. And the king said, no, only going to give you 5 years. And the report of what this is about, it spins out the story a little longer. It's interesting, but I'll skip it here. He navigated the Mississippi to its discharge in 1682, and the Jesuits published their discovery of the Mississippi in 1681 in Thévenot. Thévenot, by the way, I learned recently, he was the man who invented the level. You know the level, the carpenter's level with the bubble in it? Well, that's attributed to him. Here's something for the Oxford Companion to World Exploration. Says the government commissioned Joliet and Marquette. It's not true. No Marquette. It was a Jesuit fabrication, as I said, fortified by Jesuit historians all the way from then till now, fortified by other quackademics too, knowingly or unknowingly. And from contemporary documents of the time, the 1670s, only Joliet is documented as having been commissioned, first by the Canadian Intendant, Talon. It was a government official, and in 1672, that was the Intendant Talon, T-A-L-O-N. He was a big name, and was passed on to Governor Frontenac, another big name, who you might come across in street names and all other kinds of stuff. In 1673, it was passed on the commission for Joliet to explore, etc. And it was communicated to the French court, and these documents are available, and there was no Marquette. There is no evidence ever of any Joliet and Marquette communication or about planning a great project to explore the Mississippi. And you hear that story all the time. You read one copy. You know how David Irving says that one historian copies another historian, and then another historian copies that second historian, and then another historian copies the. And pretty soon you have a historian with all bunch of references in it. And they're just repeating the same bogus story from the very beginning. And so there's no evidence of Joliet and Marquette ever having communicated about this big project. The story is based on fake documents that came to light in 1844 under the head Jesuit, Felix Martin. I could say that until 1844, until those documents became published to the world in a big way, in 1852, under John Gilmary Shea, it's available online, John Gilmary Shea. Until that time, for the history of Marquette and Joliet, they had relied on that 1681 book by Thévenot that had the I, Jacques Marquette, we did this, and it was this phony story that was written supposedly by Marquette, but it wasn't. And so historians, until the 1850 or so, they relied on that earlier fake and these would be such famous historians as George Bancroft and Jared, which is the president of Harvard, who passed on his papers to a very important person, one of the great people in the history of this, Francis Parkman, who wrote in the 1880s, 1870s, Francis Parkman, I wish I could talk more about him now, but I won't, came to light. So when these fake documents came to light in 1844 under the head Jesuit Felix Martin, what there were actually three documents that came to light in 1844. They had nothing to do with Marquette. Three fake documents in 1844 were shoehorned into the Marquette, having been into the 1673 exploration, just as the 1681 document was shoehorned into the Marquette exploration of participating with Joliet, which there was no such thing happening for the 1673 Mississippi exploration. But here's the thing, that was, the idea was to beat LaSalle to the punch for a primacy of discovery. And the Marquette documents that actually came to light in 1844, there were three documents. I inquired with the Jesuit archives in Canada, and I inquired about them, and what they said is there was no record of what those documents were when they got them and when they were given out to Felix Martin. Just a little interjection here is that the Jesuits were kicked out of Canada and all of France in 1763. And then the Pope disbanded their order altogether 10 years later. And they were, that through different kinds of machinations, I don't know exactly how, but as a result of Napoleon, after the 1800s, the Pope reconstituted the order. They could be an official order, that's the Jesuits, once more. And so they were let back into Canada, the Jesuits were, in 1842. And the story of the old Jesuits back from the Ancien Régime, the old days, is when the Jesuits were disbanded and not allowed to organize, the last Jesuit died in 1700. No, 1800, what am I saying? In 1800, they were disbanded. They were closed down about 25 years before, and these guys lived out their lives. And the last Jesuit was Father Cazot. Wait, C-A-Z-O-T, Cazot. Father Cazot, and he went to the nuns at the Hotel Dieu. The hotel is the word for hospital. It sounds like hotel. Hotel Dieu, the hospital of God. And Father Cazot, in 1800, he delivered these documents, and he said to the nuns there, and he said, will you take hold and keep watch over these documents for us? And so the nuns stashed them away, and those were the documents. And so the nuns were allowed back into Canada The Jesuits were allowed back into Canada in 1842, and they learned about these documents, and they went to the nuns at the Hotel Dieu, at the hospital, in 1844 to pick them up. And so they picked up these documents. There's no record of what documents Father Cazot put in the hands of the hospital nuns in 1800, and no record of what Felix Martin picked up documents in 1844. But the documents he picked up were not about Marquette at all. Felix Martin, the head Jesuits, he wrote to a colleague in a letter, and he described the actual three documents. They didn't have anything to do with Marquette. One he mentioned as the most important from the glorious past was about the Indian Virgin. I forgot her name. It's hard to pronounce. But that was the most glorious thing that he had to say about the illustrious past. And I can send you a link in my translation. I made a translation of Martin's letter about these three documents and nothing to do with Marquette. However, the claim is made that those three documents were all about Marquette. And the documents are kind of confusing, and lots of people never even figured them out. I'll just say quickly, the one document was in three parts. The first part was in 10 sections, and they were about supposedly about the Marquette expedition of 1673. It was fake. The second part of the first document was about another father's, another missionary's trip to the Illinois River. And the third document was about the death of Marquette. So those are three parts to the first document. And then the second document was supposed to be a journal, a diary in Marquette's own hand that he kept after he came back from the Mississippi in 1673, supposedly. In the next year or so, he made another trip south, and he kept this journal. And this journal is supposed to be in his handwriting. So there's that. And then the third document is the fake Marquette map that I give a good talking to as one of my three installments on my website. I've got a lot of stuff, but I only have three things up there now: the fake Marquette, the fake Joliet, and the Chicago etymology. So those were the actual documents, and that are claimed to have been given by the nuns in 1844 to Jesuit superior. They called him superior Felix Martin. And so anyway, getting back to Steck. Now, I said that Steck, he wrote his thesis about the 1673 expedition in 1929-1930, and then he was primarily a Spanish colonial historian, but he followed the French too of Canada, and then he wrote Marquette Legends in 1960. And what he said was those documents that were falsified in 1844. Marquette, this is a second narrative of Marquette's, and these other documents, including the map, the fake map. What Steck said was that the Jesuits wanted to fake all these documents for this reason, because the heartland of America, and we're talking about the Midwest, all these lands we're talking about in the ancient times, all these lands were being populated from migrations from the East and from foreigners coming from Irish and other immigrants coming in and filling up, exploding the population in the Midwest. And that's when the different states in the Midwest are becoming states and so forth. And a lot of these people that were coming in and settling were Catholics. And so the Jesuit order, now if you don't know, I mean, the Jesuit order was one of the Catholic orders. And the Jesuit orders was one, like you got the Benedictine order and other orders too. Franciscan order. And what the fake documents were supposed to do was to enhance the early period of Jesuit prominence in the heartland of America. So the Jesuits in the mid-1800s, they could say, oh, look what we did. We did these great things in the early days here in the Midwest, and you're settling in the Midwest, and you want to know the history of what was going on then? Well, we were a very prominent part of that history, and we brought religion and so forth and so on. And so that's what Steck said. He said to enhance the prominence of the Jesuits was the reason these fake documents from the middle 1800s came to light. Now, what's been attributed to my work is it's been attributed that I made that claim that Steck said the reason for the documents was to enhance the Jesuits. And more about what I'm saying, he flips a lot back and forth. But anyway, what do I have here? I'll talk a little bit about DeSoto here. And the DeSoto, from 1539 to 1543, he traveled around with a group of 1,600 men and lots of horses. And the horses, they had, I forget what they call them, the Lancers or something like that. They would make long expeditions into the unknown wilderness, and then they'd come back and report what they found. Well, one time they went all the way up to Lake Michigan, and they found that it was sweet water. It wasn't salt water. And so one of the motives for this expedition was to see if they could get to the Pacific Ocean. And so when they found it was sweet water instead of salt water, that was a great discouragement to DeSoto. And this was written about in great detail by a guy named Don Shepard. Tremendous website, tremendous work. And yet his work has been poo-pooed and he's never given the credit for it. I was just talking to Lawrence Clayton very recently, who has the book, The DeSoto Chronicles, which are probably one of the best things to see because it has printed out in there in English the four DeSoto narratives. There were four DeSoto narratives about the expedition. And the one expedition that is pertinent to what I'm doing here and to what I'm talking to you about, I'll tell you about that.
All righty, we'll be right back.
Is your property a financial burden and causing you grief? Have you tried to sell but can't find buyers? Or are you just too busy to sell your property? Don't worry. We have the right solution for you. We buy properties as is, with cash, close in 30 days, and pay all closing costs. Our service is ideal for property owners who are in pre-foreclosure, have high-end repair costs, experiencing financial hardship, going through costly divorces, are relocating, need cash for retirement, suffering family loss, or have tax liens. Whatever your situation may be, we can help you sell your property and get the money you need. If you own a single-family home or multiple family units, call us for a free consultation at 888-910-1037. That's 888-910-1037. Or visit our website at cashingproperty.com. That's cashingproperty.com. Sell your property fast and leave all your worries behind.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2 keep it today.
What would you say if I told you we have a new tool that will increase production and lower maintenance costs for your meat processing company, and it would pay for itself in just 6 weeks?
When pigs fly!
The new EaseOff Model EZ4 replaces old spring-style carcass droppers and is faster, safer, and more reliable. The EaseOff lowers or lifts 1,000 pounds to or from your rail automatically using our remote control.
Sounds expensive! Can I afford it?
Can you afford not to try the EaseOff? It installs fast with just 3 bolts in place of your current dropper. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue and injuries, speed up your line, eliminate downtime, and increase profit.
How can I order my EaseOff?
Go to EaseOff.com, EazeOff.com, and hurry, because we are offering $200 off on the new EZ4 for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too. EaseOff LLC, Summersville, Missouri, 417-932-6419.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest is Carl J. Weber. His website is earliestchicagomaps.com, and we will take calls in the next hour at 800-313-9443. Okay.
Okay. Well, I think I was just mentioning the DeSoto Chronicles,
right,
which is by Lawrence Clayton. I just talked to him recently, and I talked to him 20 years ago, too, and we had a good camaraderie. And he talks about how the real story about these ancient times weren't really I'd read the kind of lots of contradictions and such. But anyway, I did a lot of work with them. And what happened is there were four DeSoto narratives surviving, and the one that we're particularized here is the one by Garcilaso de la Vega, Garcilaso de la Vega. And that was completed in 1609 in Lisbon, although it was in Spanish. And as I said, it was published in 1670, translated from Spanish into French, and that set the whole thing in motion. And nobody ever mentioned that. None of the researchers on this ever mentioned this kind of thing going on at all, because they were so stuck on the smelly onion thesis. Well, I have here now more about Joutel. Remember I said, remember the word Joutel. Mm-hmm. And so he came through in 1687, 1688, and he was a survivor of the La Salle expedition to the Gulf of Mexico. Now, I said that La Salle came out in 1682, April, into the Gulf of Mexico, and I said he had all the 55 people, all the Indians and their wives and their children, no loss of life at all. Everything is, and he went back to France, and he said he told the king's court, told the king or the ministers, I'm not sure, that what I want to do is to try something else. And what he wanted to do was to sail from France around Florida and get to the place where he came out at the mouth of the Mississippi. In other words, I mean, that's clear. He wanted to go through an ocean voyage around Florida into the Gulf of Mexico and see what's going on there, establish a settlement. So he had lots of people with him. He had four ships, and the ships were all lost as time went by. And so he was stranded there, and that's where he was assassinated too, which is another story.
And, yikes. But, yes.
Yeah, he was over some trivial little thing. But there were a lot of people that would have been, or were happy that he was gone. Mm-hmm. But he had many of the enemies. Remember, if somebody is famous in history, that they might have great, great champions and people who thought they were so great. But other people, the great disparagers and great enemies. And it's just the way that goes on with famous people. He's in Joutel was walked back from the Gulf Coast where he had been with La Salle. And as I said, Joutel kept a record, a journal, for 4 years. And so he has all this stuff written down. And he was walking back because it didn't look like much was going to happen with La Salle on the Gulf Coast. And so Joutel started walking back with, I think, three or four or five other people. No, more like four or five or six. And they walked all the way back north from the Gulf of Mexico, and they were passing through the Chicago area. And that's when Joutel wrote down this famous thing in his journal that said, from what we have learned, the place was named after the plant, the garlic. He wrote the word for garlic in his journal. It was named after the garlic that grew in the area. And he didn't use the word for garlic from the Indian language. He used the word for skunk. He used the word Chicagoa. And the word for the plant was Juanicecia. And this is in the dictionaries from the times, from the French Indian dictionaries, and specifically the Indian dictionaries Indians were talking about, of the Miami, Illinois. And Miami / Illinois, they shared pretty much the same language, and so the dictionary from French, the French words are listed out, and what the French, how the words translate into the Indian is what we're talking about. And the word that was written down for the plant, the word for garlic, and it was Juanicecia. We should be called Juanicecians.
Wow. All righty, we're at the top of the hour. We will return momentarily.
Listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network.